The following is intended for mature audiences only. Discretion is advised.
Thank you so much for downloading this episode of So What Do You Really Do, the podcast where I, your host, Dieter Dennis Mahler, talks to artists and entertainers about their day jobs. And the artist and entertainer on the podcast today is blind, deaf comedian and motivational speaker Mitch Shapiro. Mitch is coming on the podcast to talk about not just his advocacy for hearing loss and for the blind, and not only talk about his comedy, but he's also a part of the documentary we've been talking about in the past few episodes, By Day, By Night. The people that have to do things during the day to support what they want to do at night, which is be comedians. Of course, we had Claudia Bonavita on the podcast a couple episodes ago. We had Ellen Orchid, who is a psychiatrist on the podcast. And now we're talking to Mitch, who is a deaf and blind comedian. He started losing his hearing around age 8. Had cochlear implants put in 2005. He lost his vision in his 20s, and he is a man that continues to still do all the things that he wants to do. He is so positive, and it's very annoying. for someone who's not always so positive, listen to somebody else who is like, hey, I didn't have time to wallow in sorrow about my blindness or my hearing loss. As someone who has all his facilities and complains a lot about them, really made me mad. No, it's great having him on the podcast. He's a funny guy who does not take his disability seriously until it is important for him to take it seriously. I loved having him on the podcast. I love this entire documentary that Claudia put together and the people who were involved with it coming on the podcast, because I've been talking about this is what this whole podcast is about. Finding the interesting people that have to do the things during the day to support what they want to do at night. So it's great having Mitch on the podcast. It was funny. It was very informative. I asked a lot of questions about being blind, about being deaf, and how he just lives, how he gets by. Especially he gets by in a motorhome now. Like, him and his wife are in Florida driving around the country in a motorhome. I mean, I had enough trouble just driving down to Baltimore in my time off with my dog, let alone having to try and move an entire home with somebody else while disabled. He is an inspiration. He runs a great charity helping people get the hearing aid and help that they need. So it was great having him on the podcast. So please enjoy my conversation with comedian, motivational speaker, and deaf and blind advocate, Mitch Shapiro. Let me ask first question is, because I always want to get nomenclature right, because it's so important in this day and age. Do you prefer the term disabled or differently abled, or is there a one that I'm supposed to properly say that you prefer?
Just call me a deaf blind bastard. No, I'm only kidding.
I should have expected the most offensive answer from a comedian on that one, so that's good.
Well, I do that anyway, comedian or not. It doesn't matter because, I have friends who, we'll be talking and be pointing out something, and I said, I didn't see it. I said, what, are you blind? So people know me for that. I don't take anything personally. Normally, when I do my motivational speaking, I like to use the word differently able, but I switch it when it comes to that, if that makes any sense to you.
No, it makes total sense to me. And your camera drifted just a little bit to your left.
That's okay.
Honestly, if this was audio only, I wouldn't even noticed or cared, but we do video now.
Yep.
But also, my enjoyment is going to come from the people watching this on YouTube, occasionally watch your camera drift off frame, and just, it's going to be your closet for probably 10 minutes of the podcast.
Okay, well, just anytime it moves, just let me know. How's that? Is that okay?
Perfect, right where it is. Absolutely perfect framing, dude. You should get into the movie making business.
Thank you. if you saw half the videos that I take, you would never know that I had a vision problem. My wife would tell you that. I'm actually inside my mobile home right now. We're in Florida at the moment. We're not leaving here until April 2nd. We go to the west coast of Florida, and then we're there until the 8th, and then we go home back home to New York.
So, is this just a vacation trip, or are we traveling for speeches and work?
Well, actually, it's a combination of things. No, I'm not doing any speeches down here. But the truth of the matter is we brought the motorhome down here in December. We took the spot for 5 months. But because of family health issues and stuff like that, our trip was delayed to come back here until the 11th of February. We've been here since. Next year, we hope to take a spot where we are for another 5 months again and spend the winter down here. You know, like snowbirds.
Okay, you're snowbirding. Gotcha. Yeah, well, trust me, the weather is right now, there is no spring up in the Northeast right now.
I heard. And, you know, like I always said when I do my public speaking, you know, you have three choices in life. You can do something with your life and make a difference. You can sit in a chair, feel sorry for yourself and die. You can move to Florida and die. Or you can do something with your life and make a difference. So,
or you can make a difference from Florida.
Well, that's why I'm trying to build a presence for my charity down here in Florida. It's not easy. You know, you reach out to your friends and family, but, you know, it's tough getting started because I can't be everywhere, and there's only one of me.
And that's is it easy for you and your wife to travel around via motorhome as opposed to flying?
Dennis, if you know the state of airlines, who the fuck wants to fly now? You never know. You never know if you're going to get off the ground, if you're going to get stuck there for 12 hours. We took a 2-month road trip from September 9th and didn't come home until the third week in November. And then we left again to come down here, pick up the motorhome, which is being serviced in South Carolina. And then we drove it down here, stayed a week and a half, and came back down to Florida. So we went across the country. We put 7,000 miles on the motorhome in 2 months.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
and that's where I took all my videos.
I guess it's different for me where I, you know, live in a metropolitan city. I take the subway when I, you know, travel. I'm either
you're
going
in Boston,
back home to Baltimore.
Right?
I live in Boston, correct, yeah. Our subway here is called the T because it's the MBTA.
Okay.
But I just call it the subway because it's better known.
Makes more sense.
If I just call it the T, nobody knows what I'm talking about.
I would have thought it was some kind of electric bike.
Right, yeah. But so it's like whenever I'm traveling, I'm either, you know, there for a short period of time, so it's like not long enough to worth renting a car, or I'm somewhere where I can still get around through public transit because I'm not gonna say I enjoy public transit, but I don't mind getting by public transit. But if you're going to be in another state for 5 months like you are, that car rental fee is
we tow our pickup truck behind the motorhome. Imagine my wife driving it, 37-foot motorhome with a pickup truck behind it.
I'm sure she's an expert at driving long haul vehicles.
Oh yeah, she is now. She could be a truck driver. I don't want her to start looking like one though.
As someone who has visually impaired, is it difficult getting around the motorhome? Because traditionally they are pretty small.
Nah.
No?
Nah.
Is it actually easier than like a larger facility because everything's closer? It's easier to like count steps or memorize the location of stuff?
In all honesty, it makes no difference to me unless I'm in a new environment. Then I just have to learn where I am. And I don't count steps. I use what I call just common sense and sensory of the mind. The RV, you can only go forward or backwards and maybe 20 inches or 24 inches, three feet sideways. It doesn't matter. You know, it's almost like there's nothing I don't do. Up until 2 years ago, I used to wax the motorhome by climbing an 8 to 10 foot ladder, going up and down until I fell down the day after my birthday. I fell off the bottom two steps and had 5 staples in my head.
Ooh.
And I'm going to be And one of my jokes is basically is right now, in September, I'm going to be 72. Can you believe that?
And well, for 72, you don't look a day over 62.
Well, I hate to tell you, I look in the mirror every day. I never see a day. So you can see nothing bothers me. I mean, but you know, it's like I wash and wax the car. I empty out the waste tank. We do it as a team because she makes sure that the hose doesn't pop out of the spot where the cesspool is, for argument's sake. We work together to set up everything. You know, when we have a landing spot, as I call it, you know, like I may pull slide outs out, you know, just set up certain things. I do all the cooking. The wife does not cook. I do all the cooking.
Wow, that is a rock solid relationship where the two of you can neatly be near each other in close proximity over a period of time and be able to work together without, I'm assuming, much fighting.
We do a little fun fighting, as I call it. Well,
how did you and your wife meet? Can I ask some personal questions about that? Because right now what you're telling me sounds like an envious relationship.
Well, let me start it this way. My first marriage was a blind date. I still don't know which one of us was blind. But I met my wife on Match.com. I was divorced for about 20 years. I dated over 200 women. My friend said I got more ass than a bar stool. But truthfully, I was doing the Match.com thing, and I was dating a few other people, and
Keep It Clean. This is a kid's show.
Okay. With my profile. Thank you. I was playing around with my profile because I kept making changes to better it. And because I also found out that certain people weren't telling the truth and everything about themselves, as you can imagine. So I ended up with a profile that read like this. I am visually challenged and don't drive. If that bothers you, pass me by. But I promise you, if you go out with me, you'll never have to worry about me looking at another woman. And that caught her attention. I was in what I considered the ending of a different relationship. And that's when my wife and I met, and we clicked. So, you know, she's a nurse practitioner at a major hospital in Manhattan. She works in organ transplant at night. So, you know, everything is good. You know, we have our time together. We have our time alone. I don't go anywhere, almost anywhere without her these days. You know, I give her her space. She gives me my space. Me, I like listening to audiobooks all the time. So she'll be watching TV and I'll just read a book in the other room. You know, when we're together, it's great. You know, it's a relationship that, as most people say, it's one to die for.
Sounds like it. How long have you two been together?
April 15th, we'll be together 14. Well, actually, we'll be married for 10 years. We'll be together. We're together for about 14 years now.
Oh, wow. And is she still a nurse practitioner?
Yes, per diem. She chooses when she wants to work.
Oh, that's nice that she can have that time to spend on the road with you.
Well, we planned it that way. She retired in 2020, halfway through the pandemic. You know, just realized it was time. I mean, she's only about a year younger than me. So, you know, enough is enough. And, you know, she just likes to keep her finger in it because she enjoys the work to some degree. And we like to travel. There's nothing like sleeping in your own bed, which is a reasoning for the not staying in motels and just driving in cars. And, you know, with the motorhome, you can stop anywhere you want or not, if that makes any sense to you.
Oh, yeah. No, it's all the comforts of home on the road.
Exactly. But with that being said, traveling, you know, it's tedious in its own way. You know, it's stress. It's stress. I mean, we pretty much got run off the road a couple times by 18-wheelers. You know, you got to keep the eyes open and in the back of your head as well as in the front. You know, we've had people who cut us off. There's all kinds of hazards. So it's a lot of stress on the eyes and the mind, you know, and it's tiring. I'm the navigator, believe it or not.
You just repeat the Google directions?
No, actually, I do a lot of the work on my cell phone. I'm going through apps, and I'm, you know, and I question how much fuel do you have, and then I try and make a mental calculation where we need to get fuel at our next stop and where is the best place to get the best price, kind of a thing, if that makes any sense.
No, it makes total sense. So let's talk about, because you've already mentioned that you are visually impaired, and we talked about that you are hard of hearing. That's because of Usher syndrome. Can you briefly, because obviously Usher syndrome is not something that gives you the ability to dance and sing R&B songs. So what exactly is Usher syndrome?
Usher syndrome is a combination of hearing loss with retinitis pigmentosa. Retinitis pigmentosa, also known as RP for short, is a degenerative eye disease where you have the loss of peripheral vision and night blindness. It slowly comes on or comes on fast. Everybody is different. To me, I call it the deafblind disease. If you know what macular degeneration is, which is the central vision loss, it's in the same family of retinal degenerative diseases. I was about 8 years old when my parents found out I had a hearing loss because they noticed my sister's hearing loss. And then it wasn't until I was 24 years old. I was driving a car for 4 years, had about 15 somewhat car accidents. I'm driving home from work one day. I was working at the Playboy Club. Now you know why I'm blind. but I was driving home from work one day. I had an 18-hour work day, and all of a sudden I fell asleep at the wheel and cracked up the car. I left the Playboy Club and went back home to New York. This was in Atlanta, Georgia. I went up to New York, had a physical by the doctor. He said, how could you? Because I told everybody I ran off the road to avoid hitting a dog. And how could you not see the dog? That's when they found out about my retinitis pigmentosa. I was 24 years old back then.
So when did you lose hearing? At 8? You started
around 8, it started going downhill. Very slow, though. That's okay. When I started wearing a hearing aid, around 8 to 10 years old.
Okay, so, and you said your sister also had hearing loss. Does she also suffer from
Usher syndrome? Yes, she does.
Okay, is that, is Usher syndrome genetic? Is it passed down?
Yes, but neither of my parents were affected, and neither of my two kids are affected. You need the two exact chromosomes in order to be afflicted by it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, I went to 6 years of community college and didn't graduate, so I'm not a doctor. I'm a dummy, but some of that does make sense in there. It's interesting that I guess maybe it's the time they didn't know enough about it, but when you were 8 years old, but it's interesting, or it's fascinating that your sister suffered from it, and then your parents saw the warning signs, but is there any way to test for Usher syndrome ahead of time? Is there any way to say, you know, genetic test to see if there's markers for it that someone would potentially be susceptible to it?
I believe there are some people that have some markers are there, but I don't think they have the 100% testing for it yet. I be honest with you, I really don't know. I believe some people have told me they've gone for genetic testing, but honestly, I don't follow that stuff. And I guess part of the reason is is because I know I have it, and I just got to deal with it. So I do not misinterpret what I'm saying. I am concerned about future, about research. I advocate for it in my own way, but I don't follow it.
Okay.
Because there's nothing for me. Yes, I'm concerned about the future, other people, young children, but I think it's still not there yet.
Well, with your advocacy for differently abled people, I'm sure most of what you talk about is more in the realm of living with your disabilities as opposed to going out there as like, hey, let's find ways of preventing this. I'm sure you're more of your advocacy and your motivational speaking is more along the lines of living already with these conditions, correct?
That is 100% true. When I, just to backstep a little bit, I come from the food service industry. My family had three restaurant catering places on Long Island, New York. When we sold the last of them back in 1995, I got involved with Foundation Fighting Blindness, which is a national eye research organization looking for the cures, treatments, and preventions of retinal degenerative diseases like mine. I was involved with them for nine and a half years and raised over $1 million for them because I believed in research. But at the same token, I realized there weren't enough tools out there for the vision and hearing challenged individual, in which I started my own not-for-profit in 2004, which was then called Foundation for Sight and Sound, where we were raising money to give to other organizations that had programs that needed funding or needed to start a program. Some of that money went to research. But again, like I said, there's not enough tools out there, or I should say, there are more tools out there now for the vision and hearing challenge than ever before. But getting those resources has been tough, if that makes any sense.
No, it makes total sense. So let's go back to age 24 when you started losing your eyesight. What was, you're already hearing impaired, you're now losing one another sense. What were your feelings? Like, were you scared? Were you optimistic? Were you confused? What was young 24-year-old Mitch's thoughts about losing his eyesight?
I had no clue, be honest with you. Everything you just suggested, I don't even think any of those things crossed my mind. I just, like, okay, I have it. Now what? So, make a long story short, I went back down to Georgia. Since I didn't have a car, I borrowed my friend's car. I'm driving around in it, and one night, I thought I had a near miss. I said, that's it. Time to hang up the keys, because I did not want to become criminally neglect if I had hurt somebody. I moved back up to New York, went back to work for my dad in one of our restaurants, and also went to work at the racetracks taking care of horses. So I had two different things that I was doing just to keep myself busy. The only thing that crossed my mind at that time is, how do I get around? In those days, all we had was taxis. We didn't have ride shares or anything. Transportation was not always easy. Going out with girls was not easy. But because I had the resources behind me, it made my life a lot easier. I never had time to think about the negative aspect, only about what am I doing now? What's my plan for today? Where am I going to go? What am I going to do for the day? I worked a lot.
Yeah, I that's such a positive attitude, and that's so nice to hear, because I know I would not be that positive. Like, in third grade, when I started needing to wear eyeglasses, I was at third grade going, why me? Like, why is this happening to me? You know, and of course now I'm 43 and I've adjusted, but now at 43, I'm starting to notice that I can't read things close up. So I'm getting closer to needing bifocals now. And I'm like, at 43, going right back to, why is this happening to me? So I can't imagine being able to have such a positive mental attitude toward losing my own sight, let alone while already having lost my sense of hearing. Like, my entire life has been audio. I've worked in radio for over 20 years. I have a podcast. I'm a comedian. I worked in entertainment. Audio is so, being able to hear things is so intrinsically embedded in my life that I don't know what I would do without the ability to listen and talk. Like, last year, I lost my voice for the first time outside of being sick. Because I'm I know, this cavernously nasal voice that sounds like a truck of screaming babies crashing to a nitroglycerin factory, but it got worse. Yeah, it was this. And I panicked because, you know, my day job is I'm a tour guide for the city of Boston. I host a podcast. I do comedy. I was a voiceover artist. Like, if I can't speak, if I lose my ability to speak, I'd rather you cut my hands off than lose the ability to speak. I can still push buttons and move knobs with the nubs on my arms, but if I can't talk, I don't know how to express myself. You know, I don't know how to make money without using my voice. So it's lovely to hear that somebody had was able to take on these challenges of their lives like you did and be able to come out ahead of your feelings and not getting depressed and depressed over it. So that's a great positive thing for people to hear.
I didn't have time to be depressed because I was busy working. I was learning the restaurant trade. I was learning how to take care of horses, which was a passion of mine. But, you know, like I said earlier, I got involved with not-for-profits. That became my new venture in life. I learned about business networking. I joined business networking groups. I made friends. I got transportation that way. I was lucky. But in the process of my business networking, you know, like you just said about being in radio for 20 years, I had my own radio show with an attorney friend of mine for about 5 years, 4 or 5 years, called, I even forgot the name of the program we had, but it was basically a program to interview people with disabilities, those who help people with disabilities and everything. So you're talking about being able to hear everything that was going on. The problem was that I needed somebody to tap me when it was almost time for the timeout or the commercial break, because I didn't know when. I didn't have any sense to time things then. So I relate with what you're saying.
Well, and also the people who are listening, they're going to be curious how we are having a back and forth discussion remotely. You're in your mobile home in Florida. I'm in my podcast studio in Boston, which looks amazing and wonderful, which you can't tell, but I'll take your compliment knowing that you can't see it. But the people are wondering, how are you able to hear? You had cochlear implants put in. How old were you when you had the cochlear implants?
I had my first one in 2005, the second one in 2008. They were so good that my wife can't even whisper behind my back, let alone in front of me, without my not hearing it.
Can you specifically talk about what the technology of cochlear implants are?
I like to call it a bionic ear. The best I can tell you is it's a surgically implanted device that goes into the brain. And then you have the processor, which is this here, and the magnet that connects to the electrodes in the brain. And okay. It's very similar to a hearing aid in its own way, but it's not a hearing aid. I tell you the truth, this is much clearer. This is less of an amplifier, so to speak, than it is a it's to me, because of my vision loss, I don't know what I'd do without it, because communication is much clearer. Music is much clearer for me, but everybody's experience is a lot different based on their hearing loss.
And if you can do me a favor, just pan your camera to your right shoulder just a little bit so we can get right back into frame.
Oops. Sorry.
Perfect
about that.
Right there. No, you're good, dude. I was just, you were just about to go out of frame when you started selling your cochlear implant. So cochlear implants, are they for people who are legally deaf, or are they for people who are full deaf, somewhere in between? Because I can't imagine, it's obviously not a cure-all for all deafness.
Let me just say one thing to you. There is no such thing as legally deaf and legally blind. All that is a federal designation that says you have X amount of hearing and X amount of vision. That's all it is. What's legal about it? What's this? What's not legal about it? You're deaf. You're deaf. You're blind. You're blind. But you're hard of hearing, hearing impaired, hearing challenge, vision challenge, or visually challenged, or you're blind, or you're deaf. Okay. Now, as far as the cochlear, to answer your question, you need to have only have X amount of hearing left in your ears. I don't know what the numbers are, and I don't want to misstate it, so I'll skip that. You can be totally deaf, and if the surgeon said there's a possibility that you may get your hearing back, great. But it doesn't work for everybody. In other words, my hearing is better than my sister's hearing. Jane Doe down the block may have cochlears, and she's not comprehending speech as well as I do. Now, if you've been deaf with no hearing whatsoever, because that's what deaf really means, it's a possibility you can get your hearing back, some of your hearing back. But if you have a speech impediment, you may have that speech impediment for the rest of your life, if that makes any sense.
No, it does. And I'm just thinking about the the disappointment that if someone who is hard of hearing or having hearing loss, and they propose cochlear implants, and then they don't improve things. I'm just thinking about the disappointment going through the process of having these things embedded into your head, and then it not making the situation better.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I'm sure there was, listen, I had no idea what was going to happen with mine. I mean, the first year that I had it, the first one, it was like very challenging wearing one hearing aid in one ear and the cochlear, which was not set up the way it should have been because I was on a clinical trial. So they just set it up to what they thought was best. And I was suffering, trying to communicate with people. It's like, It was very disappointing. But again, it's all about how you handle your mental attitude towards things, that you've got to persevere and believe in the fact that, yes, you can make the change. You can do something to alleviate the issue and to make it better than what it is. I still had some vision. Yeah, sure, I got scared. What would happen if I couldn't see and couldn't hear? If I take these cochleas off now, I'm completely deaf and almost completely blind. I don't know what I would do. But I definitely would not be sitting in a chair feeling sorry for myself.
Yeah, I think that's where you and I differ sometimes, whereas like you're very positive, you're very motivated, you're a glasses half full kind of guy, where I'm a glasses broken and spilled out everywhere kind of person. So,
actually, my glass is always full. Life is too short, and I've got too many things to accomplish. And if you allow me, as I mentioned, a couple of not-for-profits, currently our organization is called Help America Hear. And what we do is we provide hearing aids to the less fortunate. So, again, I have a mission in life, and that's the other side of the coin. Why I can't sit still. How can I change the world? How can I make somebody else's life as good as mine, if not better than mine? How can I help someone else? And how can other people do the same thing that I'm doing? So I would say, get your butt out of the chair and do something. If it's not for you, do it for someone else. That's my attitude right there. I mean, I wish everybody had that same attitude, because there's too much negativity floating around today.
Oh, no, absolutely. You're correct about the unfortunate amount of negativity that's in the world, whether it's we're broadcasting it negativity to each other or just even our own internal self negativity, which is, you know, as someone, I struggle with mental health issues, and I'm a huge advocate for that stuff. I want people to talk openly about it. So I do talk a lot about my mental health. I ask my guests about mental health. You know, you can see I've put a couple of those feelers out there of like, hey, have you kind of maybe been depressed by these things? Because some people would be, because I think it's good to hear people talk about those subjects, and I want to remove the stigma. So I do a lot of material on my own stand-up about you know, my depression and my obsessive compulsive disorder, just to motivate other people to talk about those subjects as well.
It is very important. But do me a favor when you talk to me, and please refrain from saying to see or do you see, because I don't.
There are some colloquialisms I'm going to have to learn to remove from our personal conversation.
I'm only kidding you. But it's true. No, people should be open to talking about their issues. I go through a supermarket. I get stopped quite often in the last year and a half all over the country. And people see my cochleas and they start asking me questions because either they're considering getting the surgery or they know somebody. And I guess they're just trying to, validate the usefulness or the success of the cochlear implants.
Yeah, because technically it's still relatively new technology. Like when you had yours replaced, were they replaced because they were upgraded versions or because it was, do you have to change them out every so often?
No. First of all, like I said, the surgery was 2005 and 2008. In other words, I'm bilateral. So I had two different surgeries. Actually, every 5 years, thanks to you, the taxpayer, I'm eligible for a new processor. Again, that's this piece right here. Okay. Because the technology changes. And after 5 years, you know, these things start wearing down quite a bit. Like my last pair is my backup pair should one of these fail, if that makes any sense to you. I use rechargeable batteries. Again, like hearing aids, you have the ability to use regular batteries, you know, hearing aid batteries. They only last so long. You got to go through so many. So, you know, the biggest fear is for me to be walking in the street, riding a tandem bike with my wife, and then all of a sudden my battery dies and I can't hear squat. It's scary to think about that.
But, now, is there one in both ears, or do you just have
yes.
one for...
See, okay. One there, one here. And like okay. I told somebody, I was on a radio show, a friend's radio show, and we were taking callers, and the guy was talking about the fact that he was wearing hearing aids. He says to me, I'm wearing one in my left ear and one in my right ear. So I asked him, he says, where else could you wear one?
Well, I also just do the frustration of like when I have when one headlight goes out, but they sell them in pairs, I can just imagine the annoyance of losing one cochlear battery draining out and then only hearing out of the other. It's like, oh, I got to replace this battery, but they're in a two-pack, but they never run out of battery at the same time. Same thing with
exactly.
headlights in a car.
Exactly. Exactly.
Since you brought up, let's talk about the Help America Here, which is a 501c3 nonprofit charity, which you said. Is designed to raising money to help the less fortunate financially receive hearing aids. You started that group in what, 2004, you said?
2004, under a different name, different mission. In 2019, we changed the mission to stick only with hearing loss issues, but we don't do advocacy. We have three major points to our organization. Number one is we nationwide provide hearing aids to the less fortunate based on their financial situation. We provide a pair of hearing aids to them. And again, it's through an application process. Our second program, which is something I really truly love, is for high school seniors with hearing loss going to college for the first time. We have a scholarship that we provide every year. This year, for example, we're going to be providing 10 awards to the many students who apply. Each student will receive a brand new pair of hearing aids, providing they need the new pair, and a $4,000 financial stipend. We're giving away a total of $40,000 this year. $20,000 was donated as a matching grant from another another organization, and the other 20 is for money we raise every year. Our last and just as important endeavor that we have is we do hearing aid missions around the country. For argument's sake, we did one in Indio, California back in September. We did our annual Thanksgiving hearing aid mission on Long Island. July 12th of this year, we will be going to Huntington, West Virginia, fitting up to 20 people at one time. That is basically the three things we do. We are working on a project right now to try and find a way to help the veterans who give of themselves through military service and find a way to help them when the VA doesn't. So we're very active.
Can you walk me through the initial process of creating this nonprofit? Because I don't know if there is an Instructables video out there on starting
there isn't a
group like this. Like, how does a person figure out that they want to start a nonprofit raising money for hearing aids? What was your experience?
Well, first of all, you got to apply through the IRS to get a not-for-profit status. There are lots of organizations out there that could either be a family foundation, could be a business foundation, a corporate foundation. There's different versions of it, but what I was looking for was to start an organization again, like I said earlier, to distribute money like a United Way would have done. After a while, you know, you have to have a mission statement, and a real purpose of what you're going to do, what your intent is. You've got to be very honest about what you're doing, and you've got to be able to be transparent about what you're doing, because you don't want to be on the 6 o'clock news for the wrong reason, point blankly.
You don't want to pull a Bernie Madoff.
Thank you. There are many, 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 many legitimate causes out there. There are lots of people who just want to raise money, and they use the not-for-profit as their backup system, and that's where they're going to donate the proceeds for. But getting back to it, second, you got to build a board of directors. You got to have people who are interested in your cause and believe in your mission. And then you got to do fundraising.
Who you reached out to be part of the board of directors initially?
Initially, it was my, because of my affiliation with the other organization, where I was raising money for them on Long Island, I had built up a group of people, surrounded myself with people that were helping me to do these fundraisers. And there were several different people in that group that wanted to work with me on that project of building a new not-for-profit. You know, we had a lot of false starts. A lot of people were asked to be on the board. They were, we'll use the word deadwood for lack of a better word. They just, you know, some people just wanted to be part of something but didn't do anything or claim to have done things. It's a very, and I can't be more honest than this than what I'm saying now, as sad as it may be. There are lots of people out there that really want to do something to make a difference in the community. So again, you know, people come on the board, people come off the board. You know, it's not an easy thing, to be honest with you. And it's not always about the almighty dollar. It's about the volunteerism. which I'm very
big
on.
That's a thought that never occurred to me, the amount of people that want to be like, oh, I want to do good things for other people, but do it. But that thought is more of a vanity than it is an actuality.
All I can do is be honest about what I've dealt with over the last 20 years, because this is my 20th year doing this. May I also say that to this day, I've never taken a personal financial gain from any of my charity work. This is all me. I do it with the heart.
That's one of the big topics too when it comes to charities is, yes, they raise money, they take donation stuff, but where does that money go? Like, there's a whole website dedicated to showing the amount of percentage of money coming in from donations that gets used for the thing that, like St. Jude's is a great organization, and they are one of the, if I remember correctly, because I've done a lot of work with St. Jude's in the past, St. Jude's, that they do, a lot of the money that they receive as donation actually goes to the causes they say. When there's like the, there's a breast cancer foundation that's like 98% of their money taken in goes to paying the board, paying the CEO, paying their people. And then like 2% of donations goes to actual breast cancer research or something like that. You know, so it's admirable that you make sure the money goes to the right places.
Well, we have proven success by showing you exactly where the money has gone. We have no problem with that. If it wasn't for my partner manufacturers to help us the way they do, I don't know where we'd be today. If it wasn't for our donors, if it wasn't for our board and volunteers, I don't know where we'd be today. What's that old saying? It takes a village to make something happen. I just need a few good people that understand what we're trying to accomplish and that we do accomplish what we set out to do. And of course, like any not-for-profit, to get back to answering your original question, you know, yes, every charity has expenses, and you have to have expenses in order to raise money, because these things don't happen on their own. If you want something to like any business, if you want things to happen, you got to pay people to do certain things. And that's the truth of the matter is, there's not a not-for-profit out there that does not use the money for administrative overhead. You have to have administrative overhead, but you've got to ask yourself to what extent. And that's where I have a problem sometimes with some of the salaries that I see other not-for-profits getting. And believe me, I'm not complaining. Some of these people are worth the money, but you got to ask yourself, how much is enough? And how much more can you help other people in this great nation? Because there's a lot of people here that need help.
I'm glad you found your village people to help you get this group started. What are some of the missteps that you had that could be a warning for other people who want to be motivated into starting their own nonprofit for whatever foundations and whatever services they want to be able to start? What mistakes could they from you that they could learn?
I guess the biggest mistake is don't start your own, just join another one. Because there's a lot that goes into it, because if you're a smart business person, for argument's sake, you know that you got to follow the rules of the law. You know that you have to do your reporting. And that is critical because, again, I'll say it again, you don't want to be on the 6 o'clock news. And sometimes it's easier to raise money for an organization that's already doing something. You want to talk about the breast cancer movement? Fine. How many breast cancer organizations are out there? Are they all doing the same thing? Sort of, kind of, but not really. Some are support groups. Some are research-driven. Some do everything. But, you know, it's like, why aren't there divisions of them instead of, you know, like everybody starting the same organization, if that makes any sense?
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about your stand-up comedy career. At what point did you, during your journey through advocacy and your journey through nonprofitism and your journey as working all that. When did you become a stand-up comedian?
I took a class, stand-up university on Long Island, after taking a different class, I guess several months before that, and trying to understand what it really is involved. I mean, I had no problem doing motivational speaking since 1996. I wanted to add more. I wanted to learn how can I use the humor in my motivational speaking.
So motivational speaking came before the stand-up comedy. Okay, yes, that's what's going to be one of my questions, is which came first, chicken or egg, speaking or comedy? So when you, so you wanted to inject more humor into your motivational speaking, did you find the concept of joke writing to be natural, or was that a having to be a learned skilled?
Struggle. I mean, it's one thing when you have the joke in your head as one thing, and then when you, you know, when you tell it to someone that you know, it comes out different than when you do it in front of an audience. That much I know. I mean, I just developed a new joke just only last week, based on an experience that just happened. And I was running it through a couple of friends of mine who are also stand-up comedians. I says, what do you think of this? He says, I don't get it. So it wasn't funny enough. So right now I have it at a point to where it's where it needs to be. I'm not that of a deep, much of a deep thinker. And unless I'm in front of my computer at home, it's hard for me to write something out. Yeah, of course, the technology allows you to do things by recording it. It's not still not the same thing. I've got to be in front of my computer, typing away, backspacing, forward going, you know, to be able to focus on something. I just like, but I don't know. I'm better at just once I get the jokes in my head in the way it needs to be with a little help from people, then putting it out there on stage is much easier for me, if that makes any sense.
It does. I love hearing about people's writing process because I'm a stage writer. I have to be writing in conversation. My body functions, like my brain functions on that fight or flight moment when I'm on stage, I have a premise, I'm talking, and my body needs to come up with some kind of a punchline to finish us up, and I'm looking people dead in the eye. I thrive in that kind of stress. That doesn't work for everybody. I envy people like you who can just sit down with their keyboard with a blank cursor and start typing and writing and coming up with the joke and the premises and the beats in the way that you had mentioned. I envy that. I wish I could sit.
But again, that's not always the case. I just write what comes to my mind. I don't know the premise. I don't know the punchline. It just doesn't hit me. I got to run it by someone else because I'm too stupid for that stuff. If that, you know what I mean? It's just like, I keep running a joke by my wife. She likes it the way it is. My fellow comedian says no. So, you know, it's like if my wife will laugh at it and fellow comedian doesn't agree with it, then which way do I go? And the only way to find out is to do it on stage.
Which, by the way, when you started going to the open mic scene after taking that class, what was some of the difficulties navigating the new comedy scene? Now, you're already somebody who has been on stage talking in front of people, so I imagine stage fright wouldn't be an issue. Is that true or not?
It's not really an issue, especially once I get going. But once I start walking on the stage, maybe one or two times I may have gotten a little wobbly kneed. It's like anxiety was building up, and I'm sure that happens with a lot of comedians. They, you know, even the ones that have been doing it for big time, so to speak. I'm sure they have their moments. Me, you know, once I get going, I have the material in my head. I've learned not to criticize myself because I forgot the punchline, or I'm stumbling through the joke, or I forgot to tell a joke you just keep going. I mean, I made a mistake with one of my jokes 3 or 4 times, but as I said it, I stopped and just kept going with the way it was supposed to be. Like, I never made the mistake. I don't criticize myself.
That's great to hear, because, like, I have no problem talking in front of people. Just the other night, somebody was asking me about this. Like, if I wasn't doing stand-up comedy, I would be doing the same thing that I've been doing, just at parties and groups of people or to the cashier at the supermarket. Like, talking to people has never been the problem for me. But recently, I've decided to start taking, I play a musical instrument, I play a ukulele, I picked it up during the pandemic, but I was always playing for myself alone. So now I'm trying to learn to play in front of groups of people. So I'm now going to different open mics, music open mics, and playing the ukulele. And that's anxiety for me. That's like literal trembling hand, weak in the knees, butterflies, heart rate over 130 beats per minute. Like, that is, it baffles me that my brain gets nervous playing music, but I can stand in front of a group of 300 people and talk with or without material, make jokes or not make jokes. I can just talk and have a conversation, just talk in front of, do group speaking, you know, and not be concerned about being nervous in any way, shape, or form. But you put 20 people in the back room of a bar and put a ukulele in my hand, you're going to watch me crumble and melt into fright.
That just happened to me just recently. To your point, I avoided a lot of open mics. I hardly did any. And only because, A, it's just comedians trying out their material or non-material. The last one I went to down here in Florida, there must have been about 40 people signed up to do the open mic. And it started at 7 o'clock at night. And about half to three quarters of the way through, my wife says to me, she says, they still haven't called you up there. They didn't have me on the list. So I'm sitting there listening to these people, and I hate to say it, not to be derogatory, but 90% of these people were not comedians. They just wanted to stand up in front of people to rant and rave about their politics, religion, or mental illness and other stuff. And I'm saying to myself, this is a waste of my time. I have better things to do with my life than stand in a room with people that they're not there for the right reason. And that's the sad point of it, because my understanding, and again, I hate being the Debbie Downer type person here, is that most comedy houses either A, want to see you in action, they want to see one of your performances, and they want to make sure that you bring people. No question about it. I understand that. But again, it's also politics, you know, and it's not who you know. It's not what you know. It's what you know about who you know.
Yeah, it's not who you know. It's who knows you and who likes you a lot of times.
Exactly. So, you know, that also gives you the ability to get on stage more. Yeah, the open mics. Some people see you. Some people won't see you. I don't know. It's, you know, sometimes I admit I get a little disenchanted with the scene. I'm not expecting to make it big. I'm not looking to get paid to do the open mic. I mean, to get up there and do stand up comedy. I'm happy to be able to have the opportunity to get up there to make people laugh and get the stress out of their system by being able to openly laugh at things that can be really funny. And that's the problem, is that most people don't get that opportunity. Yeah, that's okay that people get paid for it, but that's not my ultimate goal. My ultimate goal is to have stage time, get up there for 5 to 7 minutes, make people laugh, and I've done the job that was given to me in life. That's my outlook on it.
Yeah, and that's very noble goals to have. I mean, I've been renavigating, like, 2023, I spent a lot of time on the road, traveling around, and I spent a lot more time in open mics in the past year and a half than I ever want to admit to. And it is so much worse of an atmosphere now than it seemed like it was pre-pandemic. Like, the amount of people who are just, like you said, ranting, raving, screaming about the things that bother them. Like, there's so many people now that I just want to tell them, like, stop trying to be offensive and just be funny. Yes, jokes can offend, but if your intent is to offend Or if you think if you say something shocking and that's going to get a laugh, you're not doing the right thing. You should always be aiming for the laugh. And too many people seemingly are not aiming for the laughs right now. And it's a very disheartening situation to be in right now in comedy when you're watching person after person after person just be a sack of shit. And it's like, oh, this is what comedy is, right? Is me just being an asshole. It's like, no, it's to bring laughter to people.
And unfortunately, that's not what most open mics are doing. And even though I was told this by a couple other people, and I'm experiencing it now down here in Florida, most open mics don't start till 8, 9 o'clock at night. You know something? And I'm not going to use my age as an excuse. At 8, 9 o'clock at night, I want to wind down my evening. I mean, it's one thing you do stage time at that time of night. That's different than sitting in a room with 30, 40 other people. And as the ones that start get up and do their thing, they leave. So not that you're expecting the laughter from your material, because the whole idea is, especially in my case, because I can't see the people, I can't see the body language, I don't know if the joke has the impact it's supposed to have. I mean, isn't that what the open mic is really supposed to be about?
Yeah, and that's the thing. I think me personally, this is my opinion on, I think the amount of behind the scenes of comedy that we are exposed to now, i.e. comedians talking about, you know, doing open mics in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s when, you know, you go to an open mic and you have to grind it out doing three and four open mics in a night, and you have to go out and hit hard, and, you know, and then also hearing the experience of, oh, I go to this open mic and it's nothing but comedians and they're all jaded and none of them laugh. I think it's a self-fulfilling prophecy that we're creating. Listen to these, and then we go to these things with these expectation of creating that environment. Whereas the reason why comedians went to open mics was because that was the only place to perform. You know, mm-hmm. Now we go to open mics as a way of, hey, here's an open forum for everybody to test out material and learn to get better. We create the negative, toxic environment because we're told that that's what the environment is supposed to be. We get that in our head and we create that unnecessary environment when comedy can't grow in a vacuum. If you're in a room with a bunch of people who are not giving you any feedback because they think they're not supposed to give you feedback, well, nothing's ever going to sprout. Nothing's ever going to bloom. You're never going to learn what's right or wrong. The best that's going to happen is you learn the bad habits of making comedians at an open mic laugh by doing stuff that only comedians are going to like. You're doing too much inside material, inside baseball talk. You're doing too much of trying to play to the back of the room instead of actually playing to what an audience would actually like.
Exactly. I mean, you know, by the time I finally got up to do this open mic thing, there was maybe less than a dozen people left there. So I got up there and I did 13. I did three or four jokes. And then I says, you know, I can't do any more of this. I lost my drive all of a sudden. Maybe that's very unprofessional of me, but that's what happened to me.
No, it's not unprofessional at all, because I'm an advocate for, when it comes to open mics, I'm an advocate for the quality that you're going to get out of the mic as opposed to the quantity of mics you're going to get. If you're going to an open mic with a specific goal and you achieve those goals, then that's what then you've been successful. Here's a great example from my life. One of the clubs here in Boston started doing an open mic on Tuesdays after the regular show. The regular show happens. They don't even mention the open mic. People stick around for the open mic, though, and it starts way too long between the end of the show and the open mic start. Whatever, it's fine. I get there at 7 o'clock at night, throw my name in this bucket. I get drawn as the second-to-last name at, like, 12:30 at night. I've already been there for over 5 hours, right? I watched an entire full show and then an entire full open mic. I watched whatever audience was there that stuck around window and trickle out the door because you got a slew of not funny people just aggressively attacking the people who were literally stuck around to try and support them. And then attacking them was like, why are you even here? What the hell's wrong with you? And then watch them leave. And so now it's just a room full of comedians, right? Second, the last person go up, he calls my name and I just tell the host, I'm like, give it to somebody else. He goes, well, I was like, I'm not going up. He's like, are you sure? I'm like, yeah, here. And I turn to just a pile of new comedians and go, who here hasn't performed yet? One guy raised his hand. He's like, put him up. What's your name? Mike? Put up Mike. And
he goes up at my place instead. And he walks up and he's like, what was that? Why did you do it? I was like, dude, I've been doing this 13 years. I don't need to go up in this room right now. There's no feedback being given. There's no audience. I don't need to learn to go on stage and be able to talk in front of people. I don't need to go up there and learn how to move the mic stand out of the way and learn to be comfortable on stage. No, what I need is an audience to laugh or not laugh at my jokes. And that's not in this room. So I'm not going to put myself in that environment. That is a lose-lose situation where I go on stage, tell the jokes. I don't need to learn how to talk. I don't need to learn how to say the jokes. What I need is laughter feedback or no feedback. But I need the ability to have that. So this is a waste of my time. I wasted 5.5 hours, and that's fine. I was here to support the club. I bought drinks. I put money in the till. I gave laughter to my friends who needed the laughter on stage, and that's fine that I accomplished that. Did I get to work on my material tonight? No, because going on stage would just made me feel bad. So you should always take in consideration your own well-being when it comes to some of these things. If staying up there and doing your full time to a room that is not giving you the support and is just going to make you more miserable, whether if quitting right now, not quitting, but if leaving the stage right now is less detrimental to your well-being than staying the full 3 minutes, then you did the right thing then by getting off stage, if you ask me.
Well, I appreciate that very much. I appreciate that because that validated my thinking because, it tells me that the people running the open mics are not being true and fair to the legitimate people who are really trying to do this for the right reason. So,
yeah, one of the other things I've always said is when it comes to the people who run comedy shows, comedians who want to run open mics want to be friends with comedians. Comedians who want to run shows want to make a fan base. And it's very evident that some people just want that accolades from their peers. That's why they run open mics. I mean, that's a blanket statement that is not necessarily true to everybody, but that's kind of the way I feel sometimes. It's like, oh, if you just want to be friends with other comedians, then you run an open mic because that's all you're going to see is other comedians. But if you want to be an actual comedian, you want to build an actual fan base, you want to be good at the business of stand-up comedy, usually you're going to run a show because that's who you're going to come in contact with are people who are potential comedy fans and will be potential fans of yours.
Agreed on that. And the other funny thing I wanted to share with you is I like to promote myself as the 7-minute motivational stand-up comedian. And why seven minutes?
I love that tagline. Let's talk about that. So when you were developing your motivational speaking and your comedy career together, what was your thinking for your hook?
Basically, when it comes to the stand-up comedy, I don't want to do more than 7 minutes. 7 minutes is more than enough that I need to tell the jokes that I want to tell. And it also allows me to be the first act and to get people happy, settled in, laughing, and ready for the next comedian to keep them laughing even more. That, to me, is a privilege and an honor. As far as where the motivational speaking comes in, well, that's different because I won't do more than 7 minutes of joke telling in between all my 40 minutes, half hour, 40 minutes to an hour of motivational speaking. One really doesn't reflect the other, but I like just call myself the inspiring, motivational 7-minute stand-up comic. And I'm happy with that tagline.
Excellent. And you know what? Starting off the show is a difficult position sometimes because you're the one who sets the pace for the night.
I've never had a problem to this day. Because my humor is different than everybody else's. Believe it or not. I mean, how many times do you really see a blind comedian, a deaf blind comedian get up there? It's very rare. So I consider myself a rarity, especially as I've been called an octogenarian lately.
When you're a septuagenarian.
Right. All right, whatever.
Octogenarian would be 80. You're a septuagenarian, which is in the 70s. So you have a reason.
I don't know. I'm just telling you what I was called.
Well, you can give him the well actually now that you know the term, the proper term.
There you go.
Let me ask you this. I'm going to ask you for your advice in a personal scenario of mine that's currently going on right now. I'm returning to the open mic scene because, you know, comedy scene's turned over and I'm writing stuff. And there has been recently a visually impaired comedian showing up to the open mics. And I found myself attempting to help this person by, like, the other night we were at an open mic and they were walking and I could see they were kind of like wandering back and forth. And I just look, I know their name from hearing. We've never talked, but I just know their name from being introduced. So I just say their name. I was like, are you looking for the bar? He goes, yes. And I was like, it's turn right 2 feet in front of you. Okay, cool. Goes up to it. When we're leaving the other night, he asks, you know, does anyone see a blue Chevy? He's like, are you looking for your Uber ride? Yeah. All right, here. What is the address? What's the license plate number here? As someone who wants to be an ally, what's the best way to approach someone who is visually impaired to help them? Is it wait for them to ask? Is it to offer? Is there a right and wrong way to offer someone who is visually impaired aid in life?
Okay, it's a very easy answer. First of all, anyone with any kind of a disability, the first rule of thumb is to introduce yourself, of course.
Yes. There was a part where I realized, like, if me and other comedians start seeing each other at open mics, we can recognize each other by face. I'm like, oh, I've seen you. I just realized this person is
you did it to me again.
Recognize me by my voice.
You did it to me again. I've seen you before. You got to stop saying that to me. No, seriously. I noticed that you have a vision issue. The best way to approach that is to ask them the question. Is there something I can do to help you? Or what is the best way for me to help you in navigating where you need to go? Is there something that you special? Is your vision lost that bad that you can't navigate the room yourself? Tell me the best way to help you if you need that, because I'm there for you. In other words, if you're acknowledging that to me, I never get offended. But what bugs the crap out of me more than anything is when somebody grabs my arm and just pulls me along. Because when you pull somebody who's visually challenged, you can walk them into something. As an example, I was walking with my wife out of a store one day, and instead of walking on her right side, which is the normal way I would do it, the same thing I would do had it been my guide dog, is that I walked into a pillar. So, one, I wasn't warned about it. Number two, when you pull somebody, that's apt to happen to them, that they'll be walking into a chair because they didn't see the chair. You're not guiding them. It's always best to let someone with vision challenges hold on to your arm or your shoulder. And it's always best to identify items when you're opening the door opening, opening out to the right, door opening into your left. Let them know they're coming to a curb. I mean, I can tell you how many times my friend would tell me that there's a curb coming and then they'd trip and I wouldn't.
Excellent. And then for people who are differently abled, what would your advice be to them if they wanted to start out a career in comedy? Is it learn to be observational? Is it learn to talk about your own disabilities first? What is your advice to budgeting comedians who might be hearing impaired or deaf or visually impaired?
My main thing is, as I've discovered with a lot of comedians, is self-deprecation. Making people feel comfortable with you as you are. It shows them that you're comfortable with yourself. So, for example, I'll walk up onto stage and I'll do one of several things. I'll say, good to see y'all. And then I'd point to where all the highlights are and say, can somebody turn the lights down? I'm going to go blind. So already the setup is there before I get to the joke telling. So to me, that's the first thing. Find things other than just the fact that you're in a wheelchair, that you have used crutches all the time. Find funny things that surround your life with your disability as well. I mean, one of my favorite jokes is how, I once played in a charity softball game. And as I'm walking in from the outfield, my buddy yells out to me, "Man, this isn't your game." I says, "Why? Is it because of the two line drives that went between my legs?" He says, "No, everyone went home an hour ago." So, again, it has to do with my vision, but it's not related to the vision indirectly. It's about the charity softball game. First of all, what is a blind guy doing playing a charity softball game?
Right. He should be the umpire.
There you go. Exactly. I mean, comedy is about everything, anything that can, as I've been taught, is to embellish on it that it's real, but it's not real. Like, unbelievable, as I've been taught.
And out of curiosity, because you've been, you're 72 years old, you started losing your hearing around age 8, around age 24, you started losing your vision. You've been living with these impairments your entire life. And God bless you, it's been a long, healthy life. What's the piece of technology that has most improved your life?
That's a tough one.
You've seen a lot of different technological advances in your days, and I'm sure, hearing aids have improved over the years, and cochlear implants have improved, and now we have, your iOS device that you're talking to me on is a device that's designed, has its, functionalities for people with visual impairments.
I'm going to say all of the above, the screen readers for our computers, the ability to be able to function similarly like anyone else, that no one is left behind. Every device that comes out has its pluses and minuses, whether it, one of the tough things about technology today, especially when you're blind, is that almost everything talks to you. My scale talks to me. My phone talks to me. My computer talks to me. Everything, even the TV talks to me when you use the accessibility thing. There's always a woman talking in my ears. So there's no escape from that.
And if there's a piece of my technology that I don't want talking to me, it's my scale.
Oh, yeah. I like to weigh myself a lot.
Well, as somebody who struggles with weight, the last thing I want to hear is somebody announcing, "You weigh 215 pounds. I feel like that's the thing I'm going to tell them to shut up the most.
I don't have that problem. Thank you. Maybe if I did, I would think twice.
But seriously, finally,
like I said, there's lots of good technology out there. Because I cook a lot at home, I have devices to help me identify the different ingredients that I use. Just so you know, I cook, I bake. There's nothing I don't do. You want a perfect medium rare steak? Not a problem. I can cook for 4 people, 2 people, 10 people. I throw parties in my house. I've had a dozen people. I work the grill. I work the stove all at the same time. And I tell people, stay out of my kitchen when I'm cooking.
Well, hopefully one day when we're both in the same state, I'll be invited over for a dinner party.
Anytime.
And finally, the reason we're talking is because, the podcast is about people that have extraordinary day jobs, you working, creating your own nonprofit while also being an entertainer. Part of the current series of episodes is featuring the comedians that are featured in the documentary By Day, By Night, working to make people laugh. What was your experience working with Claudia and the other comedians on this documentary?
Awesome. Claudia is a true professional. Claudia is someone with so many skills. She has a vision of, in her own way, of how to show that people who work daytime, rough jobs in during the day, have an outlet at night in which they can accomplish so much more in their lives and helping more people through their own laughter and stuff, helping them alleviate the stress that they themselves have put themselves through during the day through their regular jobs. Working with Claudia is just, I'm just so honored that she chose me as one of the comedians. Each of the comedians that she selected have unique jobs during the day, challenging jobs that you wonder where they get their energy, where they get their willpower to make the difference in the community at large in through comedy at night. It's hard enough to do the daytime job. It's hard enough to do the comedy at night. But at the end of the day, it all works out great. And everybody goes home happy. So is a true visionary.
Excellent. And tell all the listeners where they can find information about your nonprofit Help American Hear and places where they can see or where they can see your comedy on the web or in person.
Sure. First, the charity is Help America Hear, and that's helpamericahear.org. And I'm going to spell it H-E-L-P America H-E-A-R.org. If you want to get involved or become a supporter, help us do an event or something, or they can reach out to me personally at Mitch.Shapiro, S-H-A-P-I-R-O, at helpamericahear.org. As far as seeing me in action, my personal website is MitchSpeaks.com. Again, that's MitchSpeaks.com. I tried to keep it updated, but it's hard.
Awesome. Mitch, it was great having you on the podcast, and it was lovely hearing your story and hearing all of your positivity through what could be very troubling times for other people that may not be able to look at it as positive. So I appreciate you talking and being on the podcast.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Hope to speak with you again sometime soon.
The time.